From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Welcome to Soundings, Afro-American literature and literary culture in the United States. Those are the topics this week on Soundings, the first in a series of discussions for Black History Month, February 1987. My guest on this edition of Soundings is Houston Baker, a professor of English at the University of Pennsylvania. During his fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Houston Baker worked on his book, Blues, Ideology, and Afro-American Literature, published in 1984 by the University of Chicago Press. Here is Houston Baker.
In the 1960s, Afro-Americans moved in dramatic ways toward what we want to call liberation. So we had the Civil Rights Movement, we had the Black Power Movement. Out of those activist movements came a concern in the American Academy for the study, the concern for the consideration of non-mainstream, to use a word here.
Now, by that you would mean, for example, slave narratives? You would be looking at things that scholars quote traditionally, unquote.
Yes, indeed. Works of expressive culture that were not traditionally considered in the curriculum of say, an English department or a comparative literature program.
They simply weren't, respectable academically?
Well, actually, Wayne, I think they weren't even known. No one knew they existed. Uh-huh. I mean, it was a suppressed content of American culture, of American life, as it were.
So how do they come to us in the 80s? You say they come out of the context of the 60s.
Well, they come out of the 1960s because English departments, complet programs began teaching these materials at the insistence of Black students who had recently come to formerly or traditionally all-white campuses.
Right.
Afro-American scholars and critics came to these same campuses and began teaching these works, and there grew a demand for an approach to these texts that was non-traditional. That is, an approach to the text that didn't go on valorizing the same categories of criticism.
All right, now you've just put your finger on an important word here, Houston Baker. Our conversation is about literary criticism in the 1980s, and that is valorization. What we're talking about is giving authenticity and giving a legitimation to subjects and forms of study that before the 60s, maybe not entirely, but almost entirely, hadn't really received, hadn't been categorized that way, right?
That's precisely the case, Wayne. And it seemed to me that one of the spin-offs of the efforts of Afro-Americans during the earlier years, the decades of the 60s and the 70s, and the spin-off of that in the academy, one of the things that happened was that other groups, traditionally disfranchised, unempowered groups, adopted the strategies of the civil rights, the Black Power movement, and began to say, well, we want representation as well. And one of the groups that has been most powerful in this, it seems to me, is what we can call the feminist group, our feminist concerns.
So we're talking now about a kind of coalition in literary terms. Where is it going, and what ends does it have in mind here?
Very good. Let me say that the coalition is a function of factors that I've just described, but also necessary insofar as Afro-American women writers like Toni Morrison, Alice Walker, Gloria Naylor, Toni Cade Bambara, Sonia Sanchez, and a number of others are extraordinarily productive and active now on the American literary scene, and I would say are producing some of the most powerful and brilliant creative works that are being produced in the United States. So we have a group of Black women writers structuring into a tradition of Afro-American expressivity, and the combination then of Afro-American and feminist concerns, insofar as these are women writers with mm-hmm. specifically women women's concerns, mm-hmm. as it were, seems a natural. When you get white feminist critics like Sandra Gilbert, Susan Gubar,
right.
Elaine Showalter, and a number of others who could be named here, Myra Jalen, who's here at the center this year, and
right.
so forth, saying, well, we want to consider gender and what difference gender makes in the criticism of literature, and you find a Toni Morrison writing as a black woman, mm-hmm. then it would seem that the critical and theoretical concerns of people like Gilbert Gubar, Jalen, Elaine Showalter, any number of others, would naturally meld, merge, come together with expressive theoretical and critical concerns mm-hmm. of Afro-American scholars. So there we are. And we go back to it. So to return to your question, in a sense, things that have not been considered classics by a set of terms that is only now on the board, as it were, to
right.
keep the game metaphor here, that's now on the board. I mean, Jane Eyre, mm-hmm. Wuthering Heights, people have said, well, these are wonderful Victorian classic novels. But then you have Gilbert and Gubar come along and say, yes, but for none of the reasons that you have suspected, they are indeed masterpieces of feminist woman's writing.
Mm-hmm.
So that, in a sense, if the sound is there, many things that have not traditionally been thought of as masterpieces or classics become mm-hmm. Classics.
At the risk of incurring your literary wrath, a line from Ralph Waldo Emerson comes to my mind. Tell me your sect, and I'll anticipate your argument.
Well, Emerson was good at not only anticipating everyone's argument, but at answering them all in a single essay, which would go on and on and on and on.
Houston Baker, our topic is literature, literary methodology, content, expressive culture, to use your phrase, in the 1980s. You're a professor of English at the University of Pennsylvania. Let's make a very big leap here. Before our taping session, you told me that you are now working on voodoo, and you make a connection between what we call voodoo. How do you use this term? When I say what we call, are we talking about people in the United States? Are we talking about the encyclopedias? We'll get to that in a moment. Between voodoo and it seems to me a far-fetched connection. I want to hear about this, these relationships between that and literary inquiry. What do you have in mind?
Well, let me first admit that it is a far-fetched connection. That's part of what makes it fun. But far-fetched only by ordinary or traditional standards of literary criticism, where Afro-American expressive cultural products have been concerned. The ordinary traditional criteria that have been used, the standards that have been invoked where Afro-American expressive cultural products are concerned, are standards and criteria that come from an essentially white Western bourgeois canon of judgment, as mm-hmm. it were, so that the idea was you would bring your contribution to bear, and if white people liked it, then it must be all right. so that once the spirituals were taken right. from the people and put on the concert stage by Roland Hayes and Paul Robeson down at Carnegie Hall, people said, "My goodness, you people are capable of singing, aren't you?"
Yeah, we're talking here about a sort of cultural top 40.
We're definitely talking about a cultural top 40. And it, judged by other people who are outside and who would come back and because of impulses in the culture toward that bourgeois orientation, would give legitimacy. I mean, it's ironic that whites would give legitimacy to Afro-American sound and would say, well, now that sounds good, all right, but now what the way it's being sung over here in this church down in rural Georgia, that's not right. They should listen to Roland Hayes, and then they know how to sing it because we enjoy Roland Hayes. So it's far-fetched in the connection, that is, between voodoo and the critical matrix that I'm talking about.
We're back to the word what? Legitimizing.
We're back to legitimizing, and we're back to standards, and we're back to traditions, and the assumption that there's only one set, and that it proceeds from the people, usually white and male, who hold power,
right.
and the acceptance by minority cultures, who are women or non-white and non-male, of those judgments. Now, once we begin to hear the sound of the culture itself, we realize that what we need are new metaphors, we need new criteria, we need new traditions. My search was for a metaphor for a trope, as it were, an unusual figure, but an unusual figure by traditional standards, but by Afro-American standards, a usual mass appeal, mass recognized figure for talking about Afro-American women's creativity.
And here we come to voodoo.
And here we come to voodoo. Interestingly enough, you mentioned the encyclopedia. When I was doing my historical homework for the paper that I've written on Zora Neale Hurston and the traditions of voodoo or kanja in the United States, I went to an old encyclopedia. My father bought these for the children back in the late 50s, and I looked under the sign voodoo, and what I found was something that went like this: heathen practices and evil rites,
all right,
emphasizing blood sacrifice, comma, particularly that of a white child. Hey, this is the late 1950s. It's utterly extraordinary, and that's all. There was nothing else. There were no references to it here. Extraordinary kind of definition of something that is the mass religion of an entire population in Haiti, something that comes out of the African cult of Vodun, in which the priestess, the woman, is the central figure and is accompanied by male figures in ritual ceremonies, something that came to the United States as kanja, C-O-N-J-U-R-E, and,
right,
and we have the kanja man, the kanja woman, combining herbal medicine, magical practices, the use of sympathetic magic in affecting the world in which one lived, and the conjurer as woman serving effectively in a role that we can look at, for example, in the witches in the Middle Ages. They were called charlatans by the authorities, but wise women by the people.
And here, Houston Baker, we come to your connection between feminism, feminist literary approaches, and, say it again, Verdun?
Vodun.
Vodun.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
Are we talking here about what, again, the encyclopedia might refer to as white and black magic?
Well, I think that what we're talking about
the
is
benign and the malign?
The movement through where kanja or voodoo is concerned, and voodoo or kanja can be used for evil purposes.
Mm-hmm.
For example, in Haiti, in Haitian voodoo, we have the bokars. These are the people who control the dead, the mummies. We have the practice in kanja of fixing someone, even practices engaged in to kill a rival or an enemy, but that's pretty much like all religions. I mean, we can think, for example, of Christianity used efficaciously in a community in Appalachia versus the likes of Jim Baker and certain evangelists who are out for the buck, mm-hmm, in the United States. So religion can be used for very evil purposes and at a mass level and media sanctioned, in fact, in our own age. But by and large, where kanja is concerned, it seems to me that it operates at a level of the quotidian, mm-hmm, the everyday life of the people, the vernacular, so that you have familiar problems like problems of what is fashionably called bonding these days,
right,
heterosexual bonding. How do I have, keep, and sustain a relationship with my man? What do I need to do? There are formulas for that. While you have formulas for something that moves at a level of abstraction like that, you also have formulas for curing headache.
What, you're telling me that they are just undeserved, nasty, connotations?
Well, I think they are connotations that grow out of a profound ignorance. It's like Africa, when people said, stop acting like an African, maybe, and may even say that now. People don't know very much about Africa, and I think that by and large, people don't know a lot about voodoo. And so it gets coded in ways that come out of sort of white popular imagination.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You're listening to a discussion about Afro-American literature and literary culture in the United States. My guest is Houston Baker, a professor of English at the University of Pennsylvania. During his fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Houston Baker worked on his book, Blues, Ideology, and Afro-American Literature, published in 1984 by the University of Chicago Press. According to Houston Baker, Afro-American literature in the United States has only recently found legitimacy and acceptance. Many literary historians and critics considered Afro-American literature non-traditional in both form and content. In The Figure of the Conjure Woman, prominent in voodoo ritual, Houston Baker finds an inverted expression of white, bourgeois, traditional literary art. And in this reversal, he discovers a useful symbol for a better understanding of Afro-American literature.
For example, the notion of what a quote, Negro was, coming from Octavius Roy Cohen, was a rather bizarre kind of thing, you know what I mean? And this is, we're talking the 1920s.
Tell me about this.
Yeah, the fellow who wrote short stories and would write stories of Southern and Negro life, and people had large lips and hair stood on end, and they turned impossibly white when a ghost showed up or whatever. It's the kind of nonsense that America has done where people who were different are concerned throughout the history of the country.
Well, we find some of this, Houston Baker, in Mark Twain.
Oh, indeed we do. And we find people like the Irish being characterized in that way. What I want to be very clear about is that the adoption of a figure like the Conjure Woman in the United States is one that's predicated upon mass Southern Afro-American practice. For example, the historian John Blasingame, talking about the slave community in his book entitled The Slave Community, says that some people put forward the theory that there were no significant others for blacks on the plantation except the white masters and the white caste. And Blasingame quite accurately points out that you had the conjurer on the plantation, of whom even the master was afraid. Let me give you one example of that. In Drew Faust's book on James Henry Hammond, who was a governor in South Carolina, we have Hammond going back to the plantation. Well, actually, he married a younger woman who was ugly as sin in order to inherit a plantation called Silver Bluffs. And he went there to the plantation, and he tried to institute his own rule. And one of the things that he was very interested in was medicine. And so he tried to institute the heroic cure on the plantation and scientific medicine. And we find him writing, there seems to be an entire system of slave doctrine on this plantation. They will not give it up. I have tried to find the leaders and so forth, but he had his problems altogether. The slaves on the plantation were a community, and in an interesting way, were a family, genetically, extending over generations. So Hammond, coming upon it with an alien sound, alien practice and so forth, found that there was an authentic community there with its own efficacious modes of expression and of treating itself. Mm-hmm. So the use of the metaphor, the Conjure Woman, then comes out of the historical reality of its importance to Afro-American mm-hmm. culture. And I think to use a word that has some force, I think we're talking about the informing or the encoding mm-hmm. of difference. And finding
what binds us and what separates us, and how we put what sort of cultural imprints on these modes and
I think
and
finding cultural figures, finding cultural metaphors that come out of a vernacular culture, in order to talk about ourselves, not taking the standard criteria that are available, that are generally accessible, and so forth, and finding in a figure like the Kanja woman an example of a classic space in Afro-American culture in which spirit transmission takes place. Now, we think of a Kanja woman, for example.
No, wait, let me stop you, Houston. When you say spirit transmission, you're not talking about the old Anglo-Saxon goalies and goosties and long-legged beasties. You're talking about, as you say, the quotidian, the stuff of everyday life.
I'm talking essentially about an Afro-American impulse to wholeness, to liberation.
Integration again.
Well, not integration, but a spirit moving really to assert its authentic and autonomous identity on the face of this world, and in this world, and in this time. Again, a sound and a spirit that is much like what we see in South African townships today. That's the sound of the struggle, of the spirit passage. The medium is, of course, a channel for transmission of sound. The medium in what is too glibly called, I think, popular culture, is considered a person who works with the spirits of the dead. So let's combine these, and we can say that the Kanja woman is a medium, a channel of transmission, who carries ancestral sounds through in a classical way. The inscription of the Kanja woman, or one of the clearest ones in the 20th century, is by a black woman writer who is quite in vogue these days. That's Zora Neale Hurston. And we find her inscription of the Kanja woman in a book called Mules and Men, which was published in 1935. In Mules and Men, we find Hurston going back to Florida from New York. She studied with Franz Boas to become an anthropologist. She went back to her home state of Florida to collect what is called in the subtitle of the book, Negro Folktales and Voodoo Practices. It has a kind of lurid popular culture sort of sound to the book. Yeah. But what actually happens when she goes back is that she comes in contact with a community of people in a sawmill lumber camp in Florida. And she interacts with these people, and a plot develops, I mean, with characters in it, and it's a unified action. And what we find is an outlawed community of workers who are suffering from all of those problems that oppressed minority cultures suffer from. I mean, they're heroic people. They have their own words. They have their own sounds. They're resilient people and so forth. But the possibilities of being a unified family are disrupted by the oppressive situation. So you find a problem of heterosexual bonding, for example. How do you cure old wounds and ancient mutilations? How do you come through with wholeness and identity? The section, first section of this book ends with an enormous fight, and Zora Neale Hurston flees. She leaves the sawmill camp after having seen these people, collected their stories and so forth, and Big Sweet is matched against Lucy, and Crip is against Joe Willard, and the whole place is in disruption and chaos. And you know these are fantastic people. They're beautiful people. They have their own vernacular rhythms. And you think, what is needed for an outlawed community? And one answer would be an outlaw religion. Mm-hmm. And part two of the book opens with voodoo is outlawed in New Orleans, all right? But then you go on to find Hurston going through six or seven different initiations into voodoo and practices of voodoo, and she ends up at the house of a person by the name of Kitty Brown. And at Kitty Brown's house, there's a garden where you grow the herbs that you need for curing. A dance takes place that's ritually effective. She says, I will suffer for you, Zora. And Zora says, then I will dance for you, Kitty. And there's this image of bonding in knowledge, Kanja knowledge. The two people whom they serve are people who have trouble with their mates, men. And they bring the mate home, the formula works. They bring together these two, these are Hurston's names, Rachel Roe and John Doe, into a fruitful relationship. And it's coming out of the freshness of that garden, which is like Alice Walker's garden in Our Mother's, In Search of Our Mother's Garden, is a classic essay by Alice Walker. So you have this garden, you have this magical, powerful woman in Kitty Brown, and you have Zora Neale Hurston as the writer being initiated into this. And if we flash back to her introduction, we find Zora Neale Hurston saying, "Oh, anthropology gave me so much. I didn't know how to look at this stuff before I met Mr. Boaz." Well, of course, I mean, this is sounding on Boaz, mm-hmm. and anthropology and the as someone called it, the academicizing right. of the experience, because the book concludes with an appendix and a glossary. And in the appendix and the glossary, we find the formulas, the words to songs, we find the listing of herbs that you need in voodoo and so forth. And in that move, Zora Neale Hurston has changed the traditional structural constraints of the book so that the gloss becomes the work in voodoo practice or conjure practice. The efficacious movement of the spirit is called the work, mm-hmm. all caps, so that the glossary for Hurston becomes the work, the marginal becomes the center, and what gets decentered is anthropology, Franz Boas, and indeed her patron, Mrs. R. Osgood Mason, who financed this trip to the tune of $200 a month over 2 years. So that lurid title, Negro Folk Tales and Voodoo Practices,
right.
that's not what the book is. The book is the work of Kanja. So we find that in Hurston, and quickly here, we find it repeated in a work like Toni Morrison's Sula, where the mother of one of the central characters is a Kanja woman. We find Kanja practice in the award-winning book by Paula Marshall called Praise Song for the Widow, the central figure of the American Book Award winning The Salt Eater is a book by Toni Cade. Bambara is a Kanja woman. We find Pilot in Toni Morrison's National Book Award winning Song of Solomon mm-hmm. as a Kanja figure. So that Afro-American women writers have used this in Alice Walker's The Third Life of Grange Copeland, the mother of the young man who's leading the civil rights movement at the end, is a Kanja woman, and she finances his education at Morehouse. I think he probably should have gone to Howard, but she finances his education at Morehouse through the money that she receives for Kanja practice. And the son mm-hmm. is at first ashamed of his mother, but by the time he's finished his college education and become a leader in the civil rights movement, the book tells us he was as proud of his mother as any student could be of a parent who was a physician. So, mm-hmm. you see, he's recoded his experience in terms of a metaphor that's appropriate for the expressive culture. Black women writers then have taken up that space of Kanja
right.
and seen it as an effective space.
Hurston Baker is a professor of English at the University of Pennsylvania. During a fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, he worked on his book, Blues, Ideology, and Afro-American Literature, published in 1984 by the University of Chicago Press. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. For a cassette copy of Soundings on Afro-American Literature and American Literary Culture, send $3 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Next week, Soundings on Topics Related to Black History Month will continue. My guests will be Bell Hooks of Yale University and Kwasi Weredu of the University of Ghana. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Listen to Soundings. This is Kim Nielsen at the National Humanities Center, inviting you to join Wayne Pond for the first in a series of discussions on topics related to Black History Month, February 1987. This week, Wayne's guest is Hurston Baker of the University of Pennsylvania. Afro-American Literature and Literary Culture in the United States, Part 1. This week on Soundings, from the National Humanities Center, on this station.